Now, shall we begin?
Dan Black says he's a law-abiding, peaceful guy. On the plane, he asked Clark if he was the sheriff. Then Black shook his head. Clark wrote on Facebook today, "Next time he or anyone else pulls this stunt on a plane, they may get knocked out." The sheriff said he does not have to wait for some goof to assault him. He reserves the reasonable right to preempt a possible assault.
"Let me share a secret," writes Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark in the immensely foolish book entitled Cop Under Fire, which is scheduled for publication later this year. "I've had the privilege of going around this nation and speaking to God-fearing Americans," continues Sheriff Clark's ghostwriter. "I've had the honor of meeting some of you, hearing some of your stories, and sharing at least a part of your lives. Frequently people ask the same question. Why do I salute the audience when I speak? I'm old school," continues Clark. "In our representative democracy," he gets that wrong, it should be considered a representative republic, "elected officials are not sovereign. You, the people, are sovereign. In keeping with military custom," and he makes another error here, because at least nominally, the sheriff is not a military official, or at least he shouldn't see himself as such. "In keeping with military custom, it is incumbent on the subordinate officer to salute and render the salute first to the superior officer. I consider myself the subordinate officer. That's why I salute my audience, because they're in charge." A couple of hundred pages earlier says the following. Lesson number one, when a law enforcement officer gives you a lawful command, obey it even if you disagree. If a member of the public represents the superior class of officers, why are we required reflexively to obey commands thrown in our face by people who are supposedly our subordinates? Whatever problem you are experiencing is not going to be settled on the street. Oh, it can be settled on the street if, once again, I am the superior officer to the costumed functionary who was speaking to me. People with complaints need to use the process established for that purpose. Though the cops don't have the final say, they have the final say in the moment within the law. His assumption is that they embody the law. Think about how this basic principle could have affected the outcome of the above cases. He discusses the case of Eric Garner, who was murdered on the streets of New York City for failing to obey the police. "You're under arrest. Put your hands behind your back," they told him. All he had to do was turn around to put his hands behind his back. No, he didn't have to do that if he's part of the public that is superior in rank to Officer Pantaleo and the others who conspired to murder him. And he refers to the case of Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old who was gunned down within 2 seconds of an encounter with the supremely unqualified Cleveland police officer. Tamir Rice didn't think he had to obey the cops when they yelled, "Put your hands up." Instead, he reached for what turned out to be a fake gun. Tragically, that decision cost the young boy his life. Tamir Rice didn't have time to assimilate that command, much less to obey it, assuming that he had the responsibility of doing so. Bear in mind that Ohio is an open carry state. If he had been carrying an actual firearm, he was within his legal right to do so. Just a couple of paragraphs earlier, Sheriff Clark's ghostwriter had written that the police officer in any encounter with a citizen has the final say in the moment within the law. Tamir Rice would have been within the law to disregard a request that he drop his weapon if he had been carrying a weapon openly in the state of Ohio. That's what the law dictates. Like too many others in his disreputable and socially irredeemable profession, Sheriff Clark simply assumes that he embodies the law. Several chapters later in the book, Sheriff Clark expresses some hostility toward Ed Flynn, the equally detestable chief of the Milwaukee Police, who does not get along with Clark for reasons purely rooted in personal pettiness, as far as I can tell. Sheriff Clark took issue with the fact that a police officer from Milwaukee was disciplined after he killed a homeless man for reasons that simply won't withstand moral scrutiny. "Being fired from the police department is like being dishonorably discharged from the military," writes Clark, once again committing a category error if we're to assume that municipal police agencies and sheriff's offices consist of peace officers rather than members of a military occupation force. It's a humiliation from which many never recover. Now, Manny was facing this. That's the officer who was involved in killing a homeless man in Milwaukee, even though he had done nothing wrong. You might say that he had done nothing legally wrong, but any outcome in which an innocent person dies is the wrong outcome, and the very least that Clark could do would be to acknowledge this. If he were involved in an enterprise of actually serving the public, he'd recognize that when a member of the public dies without cause, that's the wrong outcome. He cannot perceive those encounters in that light because in any such encounter for Clark, like pretty much everybody of any note within that profession, notwithstanding his platitudinous comment in which he treats the people as sovereign, he does not see the people as sovereign, he sees the people as subordinate, both individually and in the mass. In fact, continues Clark, Officer Manny did what he was trained to do. In all of my years, I've never heard of an improper pat-down. If there was such a thing, that should have been up to the court to determine. Flynn, that is to say, the chief of police in Milwaukee, acted before the district attorney reviewing the case, ultimately came back and said Manny had acted reasonably, as district attorneys almost always will. At the end of the day, Flynn sacrificed this guy's career for political expediency, and it was despicable. Police walked the beat in an already simmering situation, intones Clark's ghostwriter. The police officers are not responsible for this, and elected officials know this. I have had enough. I'm not going to let people who have not been a cop one day in their life try to come in and try to transform us. People who have not been police officers, therefore, have no standing to dictate to those who were part of that exalted caste. That's what he says on page 241, at least as the pages are numbered in the uncorrected proofs of this book. I go back once again to page 113. I'm old school. In our representative democracy, elected officials are not sovereign. You, the people, are sovereign. In keeping with military custom, it is incumbent on the subordinate officer to salute and render that salute first to the superior officer. I consider myself the subordinate officer, of course, except when he doesn't. Sheriff Clark, or Davy as I prefer to call him, is one of many county sheriffs scattered across the length and breadth of this suffering land who are auditioning to fill the role once occupied by the superannuated Cretan Joe Arpaio, the erstwhile Mussolini of Maricopa County, who mercifully lost his election last November. When he struts and preens in front of partisan audiences, Clark professes to be both the humble paladin of the public weal and the impavid defender of law and order against the forces of violent chaos. In personal encounters with individual citizens, however, Clark is the most easily triggered of precious snowflakes. He is paranoid, timorous, reflexively hostile, and inclined toward dangerous overreaction to any expression of criticism, even tacit expressions of criticism. Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark is defending himself after an incident with a passenger at General Mitchell International Airport, reported Milwaukee's Fox News affiliate. A Milwaukee man filed a complaint with the county claiming he was harassed by Sheriff Clark following a flight home from Dallas on Sunday, January 15th. What is described in that complaint is not merely harassment, it is abduction, and it is an act of official intimidation that would be entirely appropriate for a subject of the communist government of Venezuela or the communist government of Cuba, who has incurred the displeasure of somebody who sees himself as the embodiment of the general will in that system. The 24-year-old Milwaukee man involved in the incident said he and Sheriff Clark only exchanged a few words with each other before their encounter took a turn. Sheriff Clark said what happened was within his legal authority. Bear in mind, this is somebody who believes that police exercise a proprietary claim on the citizens. That's what his conduct evinces. Whatever self-dramatizing rhetoric he will utter on other occasions talking about the public as sovereign, he sees the police as the representatives of the state that owns each of us. The Milwaukee man called Clark's response to this incident unprofessional. I'd say it represents criminal depravity. In the complaint Black filed with the county, he alleges he saw Clark dressed in Dallas Cowboys gear while on the flight. I foolishly asked him, "Are you Sheriff Clark?" He responded, "Yes," so I shook my head a little bit. From behind I hear, "You have a problem?" I shook my head again and I kept moving, said Black. When he got off the airplane in Milwaukee, Black was surrounded by a thug scrum consisting of six of Sheriff Clark's costumed boyfriends, who harassed him and interrogated him about this supposed incident on the flight. That incident consisted of Black literally giving somebody who was supposedly his subordinate officer a dirty look. I will have a great deal more to say about this when I return. This is Will Grigg with Freedom Zealot Radio and the Liberty News Radio Network. Please stand by for more sedition after this.
Black recorded video after they got off the plane as he says the sheriff ordered a half dozen deputies and two canines to escort him to a waiting area to be questioned, then escorted Black out of the airport.
I have opinions about the way he's abandoned this county to go on the campaign trail, but I didn't say anything like that. I could have. I didn't, because I didn't want a confrontation. I didn't want to be thrown off the plane. He doesn't dispute a single thing I say. He posts my full complaint.
Dan Black responded Wednesday to Sheriff David Clark's Facebook post after Black filed a formal complaint against the sheriff. The interaction stems from their flight from Dallas Sunday.
I see him. He's a Milwaukee official, and he's flying back to Milwaukee on the big game day wearing Cowboys gear. I'm surprised I'm the only one who noticed or said anything to him.
On Sunday, January 15th, 2017, I flew from Dallas-Fort Worth to Milwaukee on American Airlines Flight 1534 at 12:20 p.m., narrates 24-year-old Milwaukee resident Dan Black in a complaint to the Milwaukee County government. The facts in this complaint are stipulated to by Sheriff David Clark, who is the perpetrator of the crimes described therein. As I was boarding, I saw an older man in first class who looked like Sheriff Clark, but I could not be sure as he was dressed in Dallas Cowboys gear and wasn't wearing his signature cowboy hat. As I passed him, I asked if he was Sheriff Clark, and he responded in the affirmative. I shook my head as I was moving on to my seat near the back of the plane. From behind, he asked if I had a problem. I shook my head no again and continued to my seat. I was surprised that he was wearing Dallas Cowboys gear, as I hadn't seen the media stories about his Dallas fandom. I have since seen them. I should point out that wearing Dallas Cowboys fan gear is not an offense. Perhaps it's considered as such in Wisconsin, where I lived for roughly 12 years, and where worship of the Packers is essentially the state religion. I intentionally did not say anything more to him because I did not want to make a scene or get in trouble, as a Milwaukee man did in September when confronting Clark on an airplane, continues Black. I just moved on and took my seat. When I exited the flight at Mitchell International, there were six uniformed deputies and two bomb drug dogs standing there with Sheriff Clark waiting for me to exit. As soon as Sheriff Clark gestured towards me, he and some of the officers left us. I was very publicly escorted in front of everyone down the hall to a waiting area and then questioned by two of the Sheriff's Department deputies. That's an act of abduction. They told me Sheriff Clark said I had made some remarks to him upon entering the plane. When I asked for clarification, the deputy said they couldn't tell me. And when I asked if they even knew the context of my remarks, they responded no. After questioning me for about 15 minutes, that's unlawful detention, asking me who I was, why I was in Dallas, which was none of their damn business, and what my views of Sheriff Clark were, this transgresses the line from ordinary criminality into a form of Praetorianism that is associated with authoritarian or even totalitarian regimes. And essentially treating me as a threat, they escorted me all the way out of the airport in front of everyone there. I was walked through the terminal, down through baggage claim, and all the way to my friend's car by the officers. I was not given the opportunity to use the bathroom, to stop for a coffee, or to browse the bookstore. It was clear to the deputies after their interrogation that I hadn't done anything, let alone done anything wrong, so I was confused as to why I needed to leave the airport directly. It turns out that as my friend drove me out of the arrival area of the airport, I saw Sheriff Clark surrounded by officers looking up the road where I had come from. He apparently needed to see that I was leaving the airport. It is deeply embarrassing and frightening to be surrounded by police officers. Actually, it is a life-threatening experience. Treated like a criminal under any circumstances, but especially so in a secure public area such as the airport. I literally hadn't done anything wrong, but I was treated as a threat, and I was detained. Afterwards, I was in shock and couldn't speak for half an hour. My detention and this interrogation was entirely unwarranted. Although the event did frighten me, I will not be intimidated into letting this egregious act go unreported. The deputies who interviewed me agreed the stop was stupid and ridiculous. It was not merely stupid and ridiculous, it was unlawful. If any of those deputies had the dangling anatomy one would associate with a perfectly functioning actual human male, they wouldn't have obeyed that unlawful order. But that's not the institutional culture of the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Department. Sheriff Clark, as I pointed out in the last segment, when the occasion calls for it, will fetishize the public as his superiors. He is their subordinate. He is the subordinate officer. The public at large would be the superior officer. Here you have a member of the public who violated no law, who gave no evidence that he was intending to violate any law, who simply asked him to identify himself and then said nothing more. He's treating a member of the public as a threat to that most precious of things, officer safety. And then upon receipt of this complaint from a member of the public he had misserved in such fashion, what did Sheriff Clark do? He escalated the conflict by threatening physical violence against Black and then actually threatening his life. The Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office posted a meme on its Facebook page Thursday featuring a picture of a man who accused Sheriff David Clark of abuse of power, reports Milwaukee's ABC affiliate. The image says, "Cheer up, Snowflake. If Sheriff Clark were to really mess with you, you wouldn't be around to whine about it." The post also says, "Sheriff Clark regrets that he cannot attend this juvenile leftist anti-cop tantrum." That refers to the fact that other members of the public who were supposedly his superior were criticizing him on the taxpayer-funded social media account of the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office, criticizing him for his display of petulance and petty abuse of power. He is pleased that he has their attention, however. The sheriff is in Washington to witness the swearing-in of our next president, Donald J. Trump, as we embark on a mission to make America great again. That part of the post was made in reference to an email from Fox 6 News to Clark asking for a response to a news conference held Thursday afternoon by a group protesting the remarks Clark made Wednesday on Facebook, which said next time he or anyone else pulls this stunt on a plane, they may get knocked out. In other words, if you say nothing to Clark, but simply disrespect him in some way, he considers it to be his right, proactively, to assault you. The sheriff said he does not have to wait for some goof to assault him. He reserves the reasonable right to preempt a possible assault. In other words, he's proclaiming a safe space, not merely from verbal criticism, but from a look he interprets as malicious. Once again, he is the most fragile of precious snowflakes. Milwaukee County Executive Chris Abel confirmed auditors from the County Ethics Office were at the airport Thursday investigating Black's formal complaint against Clark for abuse of power. But those who support Clark said without witnessing the confrontation on the plane, it's hard to know what really happened between the two men. No, it isn't. Clark has stipulated to the version of facts presented by Dan Black. The deputies did not arrest Dan Black, ergo they had no probable cause to believe that he was a criminal suspect. County Supervisor Dan Sebring said Clark has every right to defend himself. What, against a malicious look? You can bet your bottom dollar, if the sheriff felt threatened, he would take what he believed was appropriate action, Sebring said. Black's attorney, William Sultan, sent a statement Thursday night saying, "Citizens should be able to complain about public officials without fear of retaliation. Sheriff Clark's statements are coldly calculated to intimidate Mr. Black with physical violence for engaging in constitutionally protected activity." The activity in this instance, once again, consisted of Black shaking his head in disgust. Law enforcement simply do not have license to beat up citizens for whatever perceived slight. Mr. Black will preemptively stop Sheriff Clark's attacks with the full force of the legal system, continues Attorney Sultan. In addition to protecting Mr. Black's rights, we will work to ensure that Mr. Black is safe from the dangers caused by Sheriff Clark's promotion of violence. For several months in the early 1980s, I lived under literal military rule, undisguised martial law, in Guatemala. Following the CIA-instigated coup, that removed from power the CIA-installed dictator Efrain Rios Montt. I was residing in a small town in rural Guatemala called, ironically enough, La Democracia, when the Guatemalan army moved in and literally took control of the city. Even in that environment, citizens were not threatened with violence for saying disparaging things to the military occupation force or for shaking their head in disgust. David Clark is Donald Trump's beau ideal of law enforcement, and that heralds some very bad times for this country. I'll be back momentarily.
I suggest that our commander-in-chief ought to utilize Article 1, Section 9 and take all of these individuals that are suspected, these ones on the internet spewing jihadi rhetoric, not just because of some innocuous statement, I'm not going to go that far, but like the woman out in San Bernardino who pledged allegiance to ISIS, that's beyond the pale. To scoop them up, charge them with treason, and under habeas corpus, detain them indefinitely at Gitmo. Why would we want to fill our jails and prisons with these known terrorists? All we're going to do is set up terrorist recruitment camps inside our jails and prisons in the United States. We have no idea how many people out there have pledged allegiance or supporting ISIS, giving aid and comfort. But I would suggest hundreds of thousands. I would suggest maybe a million. It's just a guess. And then you take the known terrorists that are here, and you think we're going to arrest all these people and put them in jails and then sentence them to prison? It's idiotic. Gitmo, and hold them indefinitely under a suspension of habeas corpus. We're at war. This is a time of war. Bold and aggressive action is needed.
Now that Joe Arpaio is no longer sheriff of Maricopa County in Arizona, in fact, he faces a possible federal felony conviction, David Clark of Wisconsin's Milwaukee County has emerged as the preening figurehead for the punitive populist constituency. He's been auditioning for that role for several years. He was Arpaio's understudy. He was openly campaigning to be appointed head of the Department of Homeland Security, but was frustrated in that ambition. He probably took out some of those frustrations on Dan Black. Like Arpaio, Clark is a part-time sheriff, but he's a full-time media whore. He tirelessly seeks opportunities to favor the viewers of Fox News with his grim visage, which is set in a sullen, petulant pout that he mistakenly believes conveys Churchillian pugnacity. Arpaio advertised himself as the world's toughest sheriff, despite being a gelatinous specimen who looked as if he combed his hair with buttered toast. Clark has become the most visible exponent of the view that law enforcement officers should be provided with an institutional safe space befitting members of a specially protected class. And he brought that sensibility to his encounter with Dan Black, who supposedly threatened Davey by simply shaking his head in disgust. I think the most remarkable facet of Clark's public persona is his studied rejection of the idea that sheriffs and other police officials should be peace officers. He espouses this tribalist view in which the police are at war not only with criminal offenders, but with law-abiding critics in the general public, who, in other contexts, as I've pointed out, Clark will invoke as his superior officer, but only to the extent that they subscribe to this view in which police are the embodiment of everything that is good and wholesome and decent and worthy of preservation in our society. One of the most interesting aspects of his career is that Clark is an FBI-indoctrinated prohibitionist fanatic. When he was employed by the Milwaukee Police Department, he was a drug enforcement officer, and he collaborated with the ATF, which is an agency eminently worthy of abolition, in cracking down on what was described as illegal gun ownership. This is the same fellow who was given an award by the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association and the NRA for his supposed devotion to the individual right to armed self-defense. Clark was awarded a master's degree in security studies through the Naval Postgraduate School Center for Homeland Defense and Security in Monterey, California. I say he was awarded rather than that he earned that degree, because I've read his master's thesis and was not impressed with him as a scholar or as a writer. He has issued an explicit demand for the suppression and, if necessary, the eradication, that's his term, of Black Lives Matter activists and others who give voice to what he calls anti-cop rhetoric. People of that kind, he maintains, are vulgar, vile, and vicious slime who should be characterized as domestic terrorists. After a very prominent speaking role at the investiture of God Emperor Trump last July, Clark published an essay urging the public and the political class to mobilize for a literal war of extermination, and he insisted that citizens must either rally to the defense and protection of the police, whose advertised role is to protect them, of course, or be considered part of the enemy. It's time to come to the aid of our police, our frontline soldiers, by calling this war and not terrorism, simpered Clark in an essay for The Hill. Avoiding the truth through wordsmithing the false narrative of the lone wolf is contemptible as more innocent officers perish while our politicians hem and haw. We as a people need to declare that we stand with the rule of law and not with the false tales of the revolutionary Marxist forces who most recently have rebranded themselves from Occupy Wall Street to Black Lives Matter. Those who refuse to enlist in this jihad, Clark insists, are accomplices in league with an enemy within our borders and without our borders. This slime needs to be eradicated from American society and American culture, Clark said during an August 29, 2015 interview with Fox News host Jeannie Pirro. While professing, of course, to love the First Amendment and freedom of speech, Clark maintained that the right is not absolute. You can't say anything you want in the United States. You cannot threaten people's lives. This is not First Amendment protected. Bear in mind, Dan Black's only statement to Clark was to ask him if he was the sheriff who feasts on the taxes of people like Dan Black. That was the only thing he said to Clark. And then he made the physical gesture of shaking his head in quite understandable disgust. This wasn't First Amendment protected, from Clark's perspective. This was an act of lèse-majesté, if not an overt threat to that most holy of things, officer safety. During the same interview with Pirro, Clark said that he believes that the spectrum of impermissible speech may end with overt death threats, but it begins with a disparagement of police in social media. And he set a new marker with respect to the encounter with Dan Black. That spectrum begins when you shake your head nonverbally in disgust. As a Law and Order Leninist, I should point out, Clark does not object to insurrectionist speech or activism in principle. It's all a question of who does what to whom. Last fall, when it appeared that Donald Trump was going to be defeated, Clark's ardor for order waned and his appetite for retaliatory violence waxed. It's incredible that our institutions of government, White House, Congress, Department of Justice, and big media are corrupt, and all we do is bitch, ranted Clark in an October 15th post on Twitter. Pitchforks and torches time. Once he had successfully baited his media critics into condemning his hypocrisy, Clark published an essay commending himself for emulating the courage of the Founding Fathers. Now, those men, Clark apparently forgets, were disreputable radicals who opened fire on law enforcement officers in the performance of their duties on the morning of April 19th, 1775. Their revolutionary exemplars included the black felon Crispus Attucks. He, recall, stole himself by escaping the custody of a man with a lawful claim to own him. That marked him as a felon in the eyes of what he was supposed to pretend was the law. Attucks was killed while assaulting a law enforcement officer and trying to seize his firearm. Those are the people whom Clark invoked to justify his call for insurrectionary violence. He's a situational Leninist, which is to say that he believes that the propriety of violence is all a question of the identity of those who are violent and those who are on the receiving end. Now, Attucks, as I hasten to specify, acted in self-defense, but his actions were an obvious threat to officer safety. I think if he were cornered and compelled to contemplate this matter at adequate length, Clark would probably dissolve into a puddle of cognitive dissonance, assuming, of course, that he has even a rudimentary capacity for introspection, and the evidence for that proposition is scant. While on occasion he professes to revere the colonial-era patriots, these are men, once again, who killed law enforcement officers in defense of their liberties, Clark subscribes more passionately to the officer safety über alle dogma, under which the use of hostile language, or even nonverbal gestures, towards officers by a mundane can justify the use of lethal force. Again, he explicitly threatened physical violence against Dan Black, and obliquely threatened to murder him. He's done this openly and publicly, because Black engaged in a nonverbal gesture of disapproval. I will return in a couple of minutes.
One of the things that we were just discussing, and I was back with the board, and I said, and the question was asked because they've had a hard time. Police forces throughout the country have had a hard time. A lot of people killed. A lot of people killed violently, sitting in a car, waiting, sitting in a car, watching, and somebody comes from behind. And I said that one of the first things I do in terms of executive order, if I win, will be to sign a strong, strong statement that will go out to the country, out to the world, that anybody killing a policeman, policewoman, police officer, anybody killing a police officer, death penalty, it's going to happen, okay? Can't go. We can't let this go. We can't let this go.
As you know, Mr. Trump, on the other side, the FBI director recently said there's a chill wind blowing through law enforcement because of increased scrutiny. You have said police are the most mistreated people in America. As president, how do you bridge the divide?
Well, there is a divide, but I have to say that the police are absolutely mistreated and misunderstood. The police in this country have done an unbelievable job of keeping law and order, and they're afraid for their jobs. They're afraid of the mistreatment they get.
Within minutes of President Trump's swearing in, his administration posted several policy positions on the White House website, notes the estimable Radley Balko of the Washington Post. The topic, standing up for our law enforcement community, is striking. A Trump administration will empower our law enforcement officers to do their jobs and keep our streets free of crime and violence. That, by the way, is a utopian objective. The Trump administration will be a law and order administration. President Trump will honor our men and women in uniform and will support their mission of protecting the public. That is not their mission. They do not protect persons and property. They enforce the will of those who prey upon persons and property. Any incidental protection that occurs is utterly peripheral to the core mission and function of police. The dangerous anti-police atmosphere in America is wrong. the Trump administration will end it. Note the wording, observes Balco. Trump will do more than end violence against law enforcement. He will end the anti-police atmosphere in America. You don't end an atmosphere without some pretty drastic action. It sounds quite like a promise to crack down on speech and protest. I believe that in order to end the atmosphere, we would have to see widespread adoption of tactics similar to those employed by David Clark when he used the threat of violence and then the threat of summary execution to retaliate against a citizen who had merely shaken his head in disgust at Clark's presence. It has become an article of faith for the only Blue Lives Matter constituency that police are uniquely imperiled now, that they are at unprecedented risk owing to the policies of Barack Obama. Indeed, Clark's memoir, his ghostwritten memoir, is entitled Cop Under Fire, which is a title very typical of what we might call the genre of war on cops fantasy. It's useful to do some comparisons, some broad comparisons, between this era of supposed disorder and omnipresent threats to law enforcement and the environment, the atmosphere, that existed during previous law and order administrations. In 2016, according to statistics compiled by the Officer Down Memorial Foundation, there were 140 line-of-duty deaths of police officers. Three were 9/11-related illnesses, one aircraft accident, one was killed by an animal, three perished in assaults, 23 were killed in automobile accidents, two drowned, one succumbed to a duty-related illness not related to 9/11, apparently, one died in a fall, two from accidental gunfire, six suffered heart attacks, seven in motorcycle accidents, one was stabbed, one struck by a train, nine struck by a vehicle, four perished in vehicular pursuits, and 12 died from vehicular assault. There were 63 who died from firearms-related homicide. 140 line-of-duty deaths in 2016, of which 63 resulted from gunfire. In 1987, Ronald Reagan's penultimate year as president, there were 184 line-of-duty police deaths, of which 74 involved gunfire. In 1988, his valedictory year as president, there were 195 line-of-duty deaths of police officers, of which 79 were committed with firearms. The first law and order president of the modern era was Richard Nixon. In 1974, which saw the end of his truncated presidency as he fled the office in order to avoid prosecution, there were 280 line-of-duty deaths of police officers, of which 140, half, were committed with firearms. In 1974, the population of the United States was 213 million. In 2016, it was 324 million. There were twice as many line-of-duty police officer deaths, four times as many felonious shooting deaths of police officers during the last year of Nixon's presidency, at a time when the population was roughly one-third smaller than it is today. In 1974, interestingly enough, the U.S. population was more than 80% white. It is now roughly 61% white. There are people who insist that as the population has grown less white, it has become more inclined toward criminal violence. That's not borne out with respect to the trend lines of property crimes and crimes against persons, nor is it borne out by the fact that in the last year of Barack Obama's reign, his lamentable reign, there were half as many line-of-duty police officer deaths and one-quarter as many fatal shootings of police officers as occurred during the last year of Richard Nixon's reign back in 1974. Ken Cassaday, who is the president of the Austin, Texas Police Association, is among those who believe that the atmosphere of criticism toward police officers is leading to what he calls depolicing. Now, most people, when they hear that expression, would believe that it refers to the actual abolition of police departments, which, of course, is an eminently sensible idea. They wouldn't consider that term to be a reference to the exercise of restraint by police officers in the use of lethal force. They'd use the term de-escalation to refer to such restraint, and that's an approach that was once taught and expected of those whose formal designation, after all, is peace officers. But that mindset is no longer compatible with the indoctrination that's being received by people who consider themselves to be frontline soldiers, to use Sheriff Clark's description. Such programs as the Bulletproof Warrior Training or the No More Hesitation program indoctrinate police officers to view the public as an undifferentiated mass of menace. Cassaday used the expression depolicing to explain why officers who responded to a bar fight in Austin confiscated a gun from one of the antagonists rather than summarily executing him. The man later returned with two firearms and reportedly fired a couple of shots into the air before he was fatally shot by police officers on the scene. Rather than lamenting the fact that a citizen died in what may have been a necessary use of force, Cassaday is distraught that the officers initially refrained from taking action until it became necessary, and he blamed critics of police misconduct for their initial reluctance. They could have used that force earlier, but they didn't, he whined in an interview with the local ABC affiliate. Officers are feeling so much pressure from the scrutiny the media has put on them, they are just not making the stops and taking the risks that they used to. The problem here, obviously, is not that police are less willing to take risks, or that their occupation, as I demonstrated earlier, has become more dangerous. It certainly has not. In personal terms, police have always been severely risk-aversive, placing officer safety above every other consideration. Because of increased accountability, however, they may be required to expose themselves to an element of risk rather than simply killing people needlessly in the expectation that their actions, however criminally irresponsible they would be in the eyes of reasonable citizens, would be ratified under what is called the reasonable officer standard. There is one thing about Cassaday I do find somewhat commendable. Unlike many other police union commissars, he doesn't even bother to pretend that he's concerned that the public is placed at risk when police become inhibited in the use of deadly force. As he told KVUE, the ABC affiliate in Austin, his concern is that one day, the caution that officers are exercising may end up costing one of them their lives. For Cassaday and Sheriff Clark and other proponents of the only Blue Lives Matter worldview, if police cannot kill mundanes on a whim, even as punishment for a nonverbal gesture of disapproval, the profession might as well be abolished, and quite frankly, I believe we should take them at their word. Thank you for joining me this week on Freedom Zealot Radio. Please join me online at freedominourtime.blogspot.com and at thelibertarianinstitute.org. I will return in a week, and until then, as always, dum spirito pugno, while I breathe, I fight. Good night, God bless, and may we send the state back to the hell that spawned it.
What do you want to do now, Captain?
The same thing we always do. Fight them until we can't.